Imagine staring at a statue of the Buddha, right? The ultimate symbol of poverty and renouncing worldly goods. But then you picture that same figure just dripping in heavy imperial bling in this massive crown. I mean, why would an ancient civilization carve such a massive contradiction?
Well, it seems completely counterintuitive until you understand the political chessboard of the time.
Right. So today's stack of sources, which includes some archaeological surveys, historical articles, and our own notes, takes us on a deep dive into the Lavo Kingdom and Lopburi art.
Yeah. Our mission here is really to explore how this ancient Southeast Asian city became like an absolute masterclass in cultural survival.
Exactly. Using art and architecture as tools of secret rebellion. But I guess we should start with the baseline, right?
Yeah, we have to look at the original baseline. So for centuries, this area in modern-day central Thailand was rooted in the Mandaravati civilization. They favored malleable terracotta art and Theravada Buddhism. But then in the 10th century...
The Khmer Empire expands westward into their territory.
Right, exactly.
Looking through the historical record, this feels like a classic hostile corporate takeover to me. The new management forces out the old ways and mandates their own heavy materials, like these massive sandstone and laterite blocks.
Yeah, and they enforce a brand new ideology, too, the Devaja, which is this divine kingship cult.
Right, but you were saying it only looks like a hostile takeover on paper?
Right, because if you dig into the Chinese imperial court records, you actually find out Lavo was running a shadow government.
Wait, really? A shadow government?
Yeah. I mean, they functioned as a Koré province publicly, but they secretly maintained their autonomy. They actually sent independent tributary embassies to China under the name Luohu.
Oh, wow. So they completely bypassed the Inkorean intermediaries to secure their own trade deals.
Exactly. And that quiet political rebellion bleeds right into the art.
Which brings us back to that glaring contradiction of the bedazzled Buddha, right? The Frisong Krung.
Yeah. That heavy jewelry was a highly deliberate political mechanism brought in by the Mahayana and Khmer rulers. It was basically designed to blur the line between a cosmic sovereign and an earthly king.
Okay, so by dressing the ascetic Buddha in royal regalia, the ruling monarchs were just validating their own imperial authority.
Exactly. They were drawing a direct visual parallel between their earthly rule and the Buddha's cosmic rule. But the local Lopburi artisans, they were forced to use these templates, but they didn't blindly copy them.
Right, because the classical Khmer templates mandated these rigid stone facial expressions, projecting uncompromising authority.
But the local craftsmen took those heavy stone templates and actively softened them. I mean, they relaxed the harsh angles. They added a human-like cleft chin.
And that's where the Lopburi smile comes from, right?
Yes. They introduced what we now call the Lopburi smile. It was this subtle, compassionate curve, the broad lips, that basically subverted all that Angkorian severity.
It's like they were literally carving the resistance into the faces of these statues, which is amazing. And that adaptability completely changed the buildings housing them, too. Because the Khmer's brought the prasat, right? Those hollow, enterable stone towers for elite interior rituals.
Right. But as local builders took over, they eliminated that interior space. They transformed the structure into the uniquely Thai prong.
So making it a slender, solid core spire designed for exterior worship.
Exactly. You can see this architectural evolution perfectly at Prang Samyad. It's a monumental stone structure that actually transitioned from Mahayana Buddhist to Hindu and finally to Theravada Buddhist use over the centuries.
Which is wild because today it's actually most famous for the hundreds of macaque monkeys that live all over it.
It is quite an image, yeah.
Yeah, an ancient temple that hosted three different religions, now basically run by monkeys. But that physical evolution of the buildings brings us to a massive debate among scholars regarding what sat outside them. The Naga-protected Buddha.
Right. So this is the image of the meditating Buddha sitting on top of a massive multi-headed serpent. The traditional story is that Mukulinda, the Naga king, is simply sheltering the historical Buddha from a violent, unseasonal storm.
But a lot of scholars push back on that, right?
Yeah.
They look at the intense, rigid posture of the Lopburi statues.
And the sheer scale of the snake.
Yeah.
They argue it doesn't look defensive at all. It looks dominant.
Yeah, the visual clues suggest something much more powerful than just a biological weather shield.
Exactly. They suggest it actually represents a supreme tantric Adi Buddha. So instead of just a man hiding from the rain, Tantric Buddhism views this figure as the primordial creator of the universe.
Oh, wow. And the snake represents the raw elemental power of water.
Right. He's not hiding from the storm. He's locked in a cosmic embrace commanding the elements. It's this really profound symbol of universal sovereignty.
You know, this habit of absorbing and subverting foreign influence just became Lavo's ultimate survival tool. And it didn't even stop with the Khmer. I mean, fast forward to the 17th century under King Narai, and suddenly you see French Gothic windows and Persian pointed arches layered right on top of those ancient ruins.
Yeah, it creates an incredible, eclectic visual record of centuries of assimilation.
It really does. It just makes you wonder about the ground beneath your own feet. Like, if archaeologists excavated your city 1,000 years from now, what hidden layers of imported influence, corporate takeovers, and quiet local rebellion would they find written into the buildings you walk past every single day?